It is my pleasure to introduce to you John Smeaton, Chief Executive Director of the Society for the Protection of Unborn Children, the United Kingdom's largest and the world's oldest pro-life organization. He was elected Vice President of the International Right to Life Federation in 2005 and attended UN conferences where he helped coordinate more than 150 pro-life pro-family groups, resulting in pro-life victories in Cairo, Istanbul, and Rome. His topic, Why the Pro-Life Movement Must Embrace the Defense of Marriage and the Family or Suffer Defeat.
SPUC was formed in 1966, and 6 years before Roe v. Wade, in 1967, abortion was legalized in Britain. Now, as well as being, for my sins, chief executive of SPUC, I'm also vice chairman, a joint vice chairman with Jim Hughes of Campaign Life Coalition of the International Right to Life Federation, founded by Jack Wilkie, whom we all regard worldwide as the father of the pro-life movement. May God rest Jack and his beloved wife, Barbara. In my judgment, Jack and Barbara laid the pro-life foundations worldwide on which the rest of us can continue to build with confidence. I was amazed by the number of messages I got from our ordinary supporters in England who regarded him as their personal friend because of the way he bonded with them when he came to our conferences. And I've had the privilege of travelling with him to Kenya and to Philippines, to other parts of the world, and sit at his feet while we conducted seminars. And I feel very blessed to be working this weekend in the state of Ohio, the scene and domestic home, as it were, of so much of their truly historic pro-life work. When the pro-life movement came into existence almost 50 years ago, led by great pro-life leaders like the late Jack and Barbara Wilkie, and as Jerry said, he was working before, I think some years before Roe v. Wade. It was in response to the legalization and rapid spread of abortion around the world that it all began. Our task was to secure legal protection for unborn children. However, in recent decades, we've witnessed the culture of death expand into new areas of human life, including, for example, the most vulnerable unborn children of all, newly conceived human embryos, who are more and more threatened by the giant, universal, anti-life in vitro fertilisation industry, just as newly conceived human embryos have been threatened for many years, for many decades, I should say, by the pharmaceutical industry, by so-called contraceptive drugs and devices, which also work by stopping newly conceived embryos from implanting in the lining of the womb and thus killed. A point very eruditely spelled out for us by Dr. Donna Harrison yesterday in her excellent presentation. The culture of death based on contraception and abortion has expanded to our children at school who are threatened by destructive anti-life, anti-family sex education. And it's spread more and more to targeting and eliminating the disabled, the sick and the elderly who are threatened by euthanasia and assisted suicide, as Wesley Smith, the great bioethicist, taught us yesterday so well in such a relaxed and accessible way. And the very nature of marriage and the family, the exclusive lifetime union of a man and woman, open to life and committed to the nurture and protection of their children, is being undermined and denied by those who hold power and influence. The consequences of all this is catastrophic, not only for millions of individuals, but for the whole of our increasingly globalized society. In November 2011, the National Council of the Society for the Protection of Unborn Children, our organization's policy-making body, elected by its grassroots volunteers, passed without opposition a resolution to defend marriage and to oppose so-called same-sex marriage. The Society for the Protection of Unborn Children, SPUC, as a pro-life organisation, decided to fight against same-sex marriage legislation for two reasons. First, government statistical evidence on abortion clearly shows that marriage as an institution protects children, both born and unborn. Secondly, same-sex marriage represents an attempt to redefine marriage, thus undermining marriage and family life, as a growing body of academic research clearly shows. It is this undermining that lessens the protection of unborn children which true marriage provides. Legalising same-sex marriage is not a question of being kind to people with same-sex attraction and letting them get married if they want to. It's a question of the destruction of the family, the oldest human institution in the world, which protects the mental and physical well-being of men, women and children. No other grouping offers such a high level of that security and stability that human beings need to flourish. Research shows overwhelmingly that children growing up within marriage do better in terms of health, educational success, happiness, careers, and their own marriages. It's precisely because children matter that real marriage between one man and one woman matters so much. Research by Dr. Patricia Morgan, a leading researcher in family policy, commissioned by SPUC and presented to the British Parliament, shows that in countries in which same-sex marriage has been legalised, real marriage and family life are undermined, thus undermining also the protection which marriage and family life provide to children, including unborn children. Based on research and data from Sweden, Norway, Denmark, the Netherlands, Spain, Canada and the US, Dr. Morgan concluded that redefining marriage to accommodate same-sex marriage reinforces the idea that marriage is irrelevant to parenthood, accelerates the decline of marriage among heterosexual couples, and separates the concepts of marriage and family and triggers the dismemberment of family structures in family-friendly societies. Advocates of the redefinition of marriage, such as Theresa May, the British Home Secretary, the Minister responsible for immigration, security and law and order, often claim that opening marriage to homosexuals will strengthen the institution of marriage as a whole, encouraging more heterosexual couples to embrace marriage. However, Dr. Morgan found, across all the countries that she analysed, that no causal link has been established to support the idea that same-sex marriage prevents the decline of the institution of marriage. In fact, she argues that the redefinition of marriage is either the end game of long-term strategy to destroy the family, such as in Sweden, or it's an opening salvo in countries such as Spain, in which family structures have, until recently, remained strong. Dr. Morgan explains that Sweden has witnessed probably the most concerted attempt in history to engineer a liberated sexuality, free from moral and social norms, the freedom of women from childcare responsibilities, and the demise of the interdependence of husband and wife. This has been brought about through deliberate economic manipulation, social pressures, and a massive campaign of public re-education. By the 1980s, the boast was that Sweden was, I quote, moving faster than most other industrialised countries towards a society of cohabiting individuals, temporary families, and single individuals with and without children. The culmination of such policies was that the Scandinavian nations became the first in the world to recognise homosexual unions, with Denmark in 1989, followed by Norway in 1994, and Sweden in 1995. Now, the boast, as I say, in Sweden, according to Dr. Morgan's research, is that the model society for the future is cohabiting individuals, temporary families, and single individuals with and without children. Our opponents can only achieve this through the destruction of the traditional family, our families, and thus destroying the possibility of healthy and normal family life for our children and grandchildren, born and unborn. Spain provides a good example of how same-sex marriage is an effective weapon against the traditional family structure. In Spain, family structures had remained relatively strong. However, the recognition of so-called same-sex marriage in 2005 was followed by a pronounced acceleration in the decline of real marriage. The annual number of marriages fell by an average of nearly 15,000 during the 3 years immediately after the legislation, and for the next 3 years after that, the annual fall was 34,000. The destruction of traditional family structures has very grave consequences for all members of society, but it is children born and unborn who are especially vulnerable. Government statistics from the United Kingdom show that children conceived outside of marriage are 4 to 5 times more likely to be aborted than those conceived within marriage. There's a website I looked up when I was preparing this talk called Rainforest Concern. Rainforest Concern tells us that half of the Earth's wildlife and at least two-thirds of its plant species live in tropical rainforests. These plants, they say, provide food and shelter for many rare animals that depend on the rainforest for their survival. Destroy the rainforest and you destroy protection for that wildlife, they tell us. In the same way, the family founded on marriage between a man and a woman is the natural habitat of children, both born and unborn. Indeed, the natural family is a pre-political and pre-Christian institution. Destroy that institution in society and you destroy protection for children born and unborn. Historically, our nation's laws protected unborn children from being killed. And so, quite logically and rightly, pro-life movements worldwide have worked tirelessly to restore or to uphold such laws. By the same token, historically, families based on the indissoluble union in marriage of a man and a woman have provided children, both born and unborn, with their best hope of life and fulfilment in life. So, quite logically and rightly, pro-life movements worldwide, like Cleveland Right to Life, must work tirelessly to defend marriage and the family. The pro-life movement cannot possibly succeed in its efforts to end abortion if the family based on marriage between a man and a woman is destroyed. What's more, a major way in which the so-called homosexual rights lobby is actively undermining the family and the culture of life is through targeting its message at little boys and little girls in their primary schools. In the UK, I'm talking about, perhaps the pattern is similar elsewhere. I'm ashamed to say, as a Catholic myself, this is happening too in Catholic primary schools. I'm sorry to have to share with you that homosexual militants are being invited into schools in Britain, including into Catholic schools with the blessing of the local bishop, to train teachers how to educate little boys as young as 4 years old, that they might grow up to marry a man rather than a woman, and the same with little girls. Catholic schools in Britain and around the world have long been complicit, I'm sorry to say, in the culture of death, providing access to abortion and contraception for under 16s without parental knowledge. This is happening with the cooperation of the Catholic authorities, and if anyone wants more evidence on that, I'm only too happy to provide it. Now, what happens when little Johnny at, say, Our Lady's Primary School in South London, where I hail from, says to his teacher, "Please, miss, can boys who grow up to marry a man have babies like mummies and daddies can?" Without a shadow of doubt, very many teachers will say, "Yes, they can." In a different way, but yes, they can. As you know, same-sex couples are demanding the right to have children, making it even more difficult for pro-life groups effectively to oppose surrogacy and in vitro fertilisation. According to peer-reviewed research, for every baby born by IVF, 23 are discarded or frozen or used in destructive experiments or miscarry. Defending the right to life of unborn children, such as these, will be increasingly viewed as an attack on the rights of homosexual couples. Thus, this is one of the fundamental reasons why, as the title of my talk this morning states, the pro-life movement must embrace the defence of marriage and the family or face defeat. No wonder Pope John Paul II made it clear that there's no hope of building a culture of life without teaching young people the truth about human sexuality. I'm a Catholic, as I say, as was Pope John Paul II, you won't be surprised to hear. My only joke. But I quote Pope St. John Paul II in this context, in his role as a prophet speaking to the whole of humanity, regardless of people's religion or belief in God. He wrote in his great pro-life encyclical Evangelium Vitae, number 97. In particular, he said, there's a need for education about the value of life from its very origins. It's an illusion to think that we can build a true culture of human life if we do not help the young to accept and experience sexuality and love and the whole of life according to their true meaning and in their close interconnection. Pope John Paul continued, sexuality which enriches the whole person manifests its inmost meaning in leading the person to the gift of self in love. The trivialization of sexuality is amongst the principal factors which have led to contempt for new life. Only a true love is able to protect life. And he concludes, there can be no avoiding the duty to offer, especially to adolescents and young adults, an authentic education in sexuality and in love, an education which involves training in chastity as a virtue, which fosters personal maturity, and makes one capable of respecting the spousal meaning of the body. I think it's all there. It's important that we realise that the persecution of the Christian faithful and of all who adhere to the moral law written in our hearts, not least parents of school-aged children, is not something to be feared for the future, but it's something which is already here. During recent weeks and months in Britain, our organisation, the Society for the Protection of Unborn Children, has been funding at great expense the employment tribunal battle of a Catholic teacher in a Catholic school forbidden by order of the Catholic authorities, including by the local bishop, from spreading the case against the legalisation of same-sex marriage amongst his fellow teachers. I'm sure you're all well aware of many cases across the world in which individuals from all walks of life, bakers, hoteliers, firemen, policemen, florists, registrars, and no doubt many others have had their livelihoods threatened and destroyed by an aggressive and intolerant homosexual lobby. One can see why, during the Eucharistic Congress in Philadelphia in 1976, the future John Paul II told those gathered, and I quote, "We are now standing in the face of the greatest historical confrontation humanity has ever experienced. I do not think," he said, "that the wide circle of the American society or the whole wide circle of the Christian community realize this fully. We are now facing a final confrontation between the church and the anti-church, between the gospel and the anti-gospel, between Christ and the antichrist. The confrontation lies within the plans of divine providence," he said. "It's therefore in God's plan, and it must be a trial which the church must take up and face courageously." Unfortunately, such courage has often not been forthcoming. I speak again as a Catholic. I'm a pro-life leader who happens to be a Catholic, and there's no reason why I should hide that fact. Indeed, I believe there's every reason for a pro-life leader to focus on the profoundly grave problems in his own church, and I intend to do so for the sake of giving witness to Christ, who founded the church, and for the sake of authentic church renewal. Throughout Britain, Europe, and North America, and much of the world, the failure of many Catholic bishops to teach their flocks on matters relating to sexuality and the fundamental right to life is directly responsible for great confusion, and consequently for the failure of the overwhelming majority of Catholics, both clerical and lay, to provide truly effective resistance to the greatest legalized slaughter of human beings in the history of the world. Countless millions of unborn children are being killed each year, and the policy of very many Catholic bishops in Europe and elsewhere is contributing hugely to this deplorable situation. The policy in England and Wales, for example, as I've said, includes complicity, clearly on record, with the provision, without the knowledge of their parents, of contraception and abortion advice and services to children under the age of consent attending Catholic schools. Yesterday, John Henry Weston was speaking about Pope Paul VI's prophecy that it wouldn't be long before governments imposed on countries what couples regarded as lawful in the intimacy of their married lives. What he didn't foresee in Humanae Vitae is that that kind of policy would be imposed on parents by Catholic bishops in my country. Because what is it except imposing without the permission of responsible people abortion and contraception? That's what the policy of the bishops of England and Wales is. Also in England and Wales, rather than offer steadfast opposition to the homosexual agenda, the bishops' conference has cravenly surrendered by producing scandalous equality guidelines which utterly betray the lay faithful, and especially parents who are trying to bring up their children in conformity with the natural moral law and the teaching of the church. These guidelines insist, for example, that Catholic institutions, including Catholic schools, must comply with British government and EU legislation requiring equal employment rights of male and female homosexuals and bisexuals and transsexuals. Indeed, the bishop's policy statement welcomes this legislation, seeks to implement it within the church, and promises to monitor its implementation, including in Catholic schools. Since the bishop's guidelines were published, a pro-abortion document prepared at the request of the European Union on conscientious objection links rights related to sexual orientation to other supposed rights, including the right to abortion and the right to euthanasia and assisted suicide. And the EU Commission document quotes in part from the diversity and equality guidelines of the Catholics, bishops of England and Wales in a generally approving way. Thus, the policy of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales in its diversity and equality guidelines is helping the British government to promote the homosexual agenda throughout Europe via a document from the European Commission, which in its turn links homosexual rights to abortion rights. Pro-life movements around the world ignore these kinds of development which have massive geopolitical significance at their peril. And I'm aware that you encounter similar evils in the United States. The Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Cardinal Nichols, has publicly stated that the Church may one day recognise homosexual unions. Now, despite this bold contradiction of the Church's unchangeable teaching on this matter, he was recently selected to serve on the congregation responsible for the appointment of new bishops. He was appointed to that congregation at the same time that that great pro-life champion, Cardinal Raymond Burke, was removed from it. By way of complete contrast, I would like to extend my heartfelt thanks as a parent to the Catholic bishops of Nigeria. Last year, they publicly thanked Goodluck Jonathan, Nigeria's president, for signing into law the same-sex marriage prohibition bill, which prohibits same-sex marriages, civil partnerships, and the promotion of homosexuality. Archbishop Ignatius Kaigama, president of the Bishops' Conference, commended President Jonathan for his decision not to bow to international pressure in the promotion of unethical and immoral practices of same-sex union and other related vices. And he spoke of the conspiracy of the developed world to make our country and continent the dumping ground for the promotion of all immoral practices that have continued to debase the purpose of God for man in the area of creation and morality in their own countries. Archbishop Kaigama and other African bishops also offered a courageous defence of the unchangeable teachings of the Church on matters relating to human sexuality at the extraordinary Synod on the Family held last October in Rome. Now, I was at the Synod as co-founder of the Voice of the Family, an international coalition of 23 pro-life and pro-family groups representing people from many nations and five continents. The Synod was ostensibly called to find solutions to the crisis facing the family in our world today. In fact, as I'm sure most of you are already very well aware, the Synod threatened to make a situation a good deal worse. It's just the tip of the iceberg, as you'll see, but there's no direct reference in the final document on the family, on abortion, and a billion of which at least have occurred over the last 50 years. And there's no reference to euthanasia that happens in the heart of the family. There's a scandalous, ambiguous reference to reproductive health, a term used by our opponents. Now, during the Synod, those faithful to unchangeable Catholic teaching had to defend marriage from assaults coming from within the Church by a well-organized, highly disciplined group of senior prelates who were determined to undermine her immutable teachings. I must tell you that our team personally witnessed scenes of dissent and manipulation carried out by the official organs of the Holy See on a scale that I could not previously have envisaged. Many of you will be well aware that halfway through the Synod, a scandalous document containing very grave errors was presented to the press, which purported to be an interim report reflecting the discussions of the Synod Fathers. In fact, as the Archbishop of Durban Wilfrid Cardinal Napier immediately pointed out the report did not accurately represent the views of the bishops. Cardinal Napier said, and I quote, "The message has gone out. This is what the synod is saying. This is what the Catholic Church is saying." He said, "And it's not what we're saying at all." George Cardinal Pell, prefect for the economy, stated that the document, and I quote, "didn't represent accurately the feelings of the Synod Fathers and was tendentious and skewed." He continued, "One father said to me that he wouldn't want his young adult children to read it because they'd be confused." This is the gravity of the situation today. Catholic fathers don't want their children reading documents produced by authorities in Rome. It's crucially important to get to grips with this document, especially for Catholics, but also non-Catholics, if I may say so, because it's nothing less than the manifesto of a group within the Church who wishes to dismantle her entire edifice of teaching on human sexuality, which is such a crucial part of defending life and marriage in our historic pro-life struggle. We ignore this at our peril. The document contains many gravely problematic aspects, but I wish to focus on what I consider the two major threats to marriage and the family contained within it. The first is the attempt to change the teaching of the Church on the question of the admission of the divorced and remarried to Holy Communion without amendment of life. Now, as we all know, the Catholic Church has clearly taught since the beginning of her existence that a ratified and consummated sacramental marriage cannot be dissolved by any authority on earth. This teaching has been repeated unceasingly by the Church for 20 centuries without prejudice to the annulment procedures whose purpose are to discover if there was a valid marriage contract in the first place. So we must ask, why is sacramental marriage now being challenged? Cardinal Pell has publicly stated that this proposal is a stalking horse being proposed by radical elements within the Church who want, and I quote the Cardinal, and he was at the Synod and heard the entire proceedings, who want wider changes, recognition of civil unions, recognition of homosexual unions. Let's be clear. Cardinal Pell is telling us that there are figures at the highest level of the Church who want the Church to approve of homosexual unions. Indeed, as I said earlier, this is already considered to be an open question by influential clerics such as Cardinal Neckels of Westminster. It causes me great pain to say, but our families are now being threatened not only by those who hold power in the state, but also by those who hold power in the Church. And we need to draw a distinction between those who hold power in the Church and the Church itself, the Bride of Christ. Let's reflect for a moment on those passages in the interim report which suggest that the Church should identify and affirm positive aspects of gravely sinful relationships. The report states, and I quote, "A new element in today's pastoral activity is a sensitivity to the positive aspects of civilly celebrated marriages and, with obvious differences, cohabitation. While clearly presenting the ideal, the Church needs also to indicate the constructive elements in these situations which do not yet or no longer correspond to that ideal." It continues in a section entitled "The discernment of values present in wounded families and in irregular situations." And I quote, "Some ask whether the sacramental fullness of marriage does not exclude the possibility of recognizing positive elements, even the imperfect forms that may be found outside this nuptial situation, which are in any case ordered in relation to it." Now, there's obviously a great deal that could be said about such proposals, but I want to suggest a few key points for your reflection. It's the duty of the Church to lead people to life in Jesus Christ, who is the way, the truth, and the life. It is impossible to find true peace and happiness if we live in a way that is contrary to the truths of the moral law, which are accessible to us through the use of reason and in the authoritative teaching of the church. It is therefore a solemn duty of the church to teach the truth in love, in season and out of season. Now, like I'm sure many of you here, I don't speak from some ivory tower. I have a family that's as broken by the modern world as the next one. But this is not helping me to bring mercy and compassion to my family by telling them lies. By focusing on supposedly positively aspects of objectively sinful unions, we deny people the full truth and risk giving them a false understanding of their situation. We not only run the risk of giving them excuses not to change their lives, but also seem to suggest that the church in some way approves of their behaviour. The confusion only deepens when we turn to the section dealing with homosexuality. The document states, and I quote, "Homosexuals have gifts and qualities to offer to the Christian community. Are we capable of providing these for these people, guaranteeing them a place of fellowship in our communities? Oftentimes they want to encounter a church which offers them a welcoming home. Wait for it. Are our communities capable of this, accepting and valuing their sexual orientation?" It continues. "Without denying the moral problems connected to homosexual unions, it has to be noted that there are cases in which mutual aid to the point of sacrifice constitutes a precious support to the, in the life of the partners." And it goes on to say that, and I quote, "unions between people of the same sex cannot be considered on the same level as marriage between man and a woman," which of course implies that there is a level on which they can be accepted. Perhaps most disturbingly of all, the document speaks of, and I quote, "children who live with homosexual couples," without giving any indication whatsoever that there's anything objectively wrong with this situation. There is much that can be said about all these passages. Firstly, we must never tire of pointing out that the value and dignity of every human being lies in our creation in the image and likeness of God and our possession of a rational soul capable of knowing and choosing the good. It is an offence against human dignity to say that the church must accept and value a sexual orientation which the Catholic Church teaches is, quote, "intrinsically disordered." This is a false mercy, a false compassion, which shows no interest for the good of the faithful, no interest for the good of the individual who's at risk of being confirmed in behaviour which the Catechism refers to as, quotes, "great depravity." Note well, there's nothing, absolutely nothing in this entire section which indicates that homosexual acts are sinful. This is false mercy, false compassion, and one must question what's foremost in the minds of these clerics. Do they genuinely care about individuals struggling with homosexual tendencies or those who are divorced or remarried? Or is this rather a political act, the first step towards destroying the entire edifice of Catholic teaching on matters relating to human sexuality? His Eminence Raymond Cardinal Burke has stated, quotes, "You do not have to be a rocket science to see the approach at work, which is certainly not of the church," unquote. And of course, as always, it's primarily the good of children, which is to be sacrificed on the altar of sexual rights for adults. It was precisely for these reasons, because the gravity of the threat that was realized, that many cardinals and bishops have spoken out strongly, not only against this document, but against the entire way in which the synod was conducted. Senior prelates had publicly protested against the consistent manipulation of the Synod Fathers by the organisers of the Synod and against the censorship and distortion that they were subjected to by the Vatican Press Office. Cardinal Burke said, "It's clear that whoever wrote the Relatio, that's the final report, has an agenda and simply used the authority of a solemn meeting of cardinals and bishops to advance his agenda without respect for the discussion which took place during the first week of the Synod." He continued, "The fact that none of the interventions of the Synod Fathers were permitted to be published and that their content was filtered through the daily briefings organised by Father Lombardi facilitated that manipulation. Despite such protests, the manipulation continues. A team from the Society for the Protection of Unborn Children and other Voice of the Family colleagues recently attended a conference on the Synod organised by the Pontifical Council for the Family in Rome, which I first got to know under the great leadership of Cardinal Lopez Trujillo. The conference was purportedly organised to allow lay groups to contribute to the Pontifical Council's own input into the Synod. However, it rapidly became clear to my colleagues that opinions which challenged the radical agenda were not welcomed by some of those persons responsible for the conference. Our team raised the issues of abortion, parental rights, assisted suicide, gender theory, and many other important topics. Yet the relators of the English language group failed to relay any of these contributions to the plenary sessions, and yet they were quite happy to relay contributions about issues such as transgender rights. I'm also sorry to have to inform you that the president of the Pontifical Council for the Family, Monsignor Vincenzo Paglia, not only refused, when asked, to uphold the Church's teaching on Holy Communion for the divorced and remarried, but in fact strongly indicated that he would accept a change of the doctrine. Now, to those in the Church who argue that what's being proposed is not a change of doctrine about marriage, but simply a change in the Church's discipline, here's what Cardinal Burke had to say in an interview with Rorate Caeli earlier this month on the 2nd of March. I quote, "I think it's very important to address a false dichotomy that's been drawn by some who say, oh no, we're just changing discipline. We're not touching the Church's doctrine." But he says, if you change the Church's discipline with regard to Holy Communion by those who are living in adultery, then surely you are changing the Church's doctrine on adultery. You're saying that in certain circumstances, adultery is permissible and even good if people can live in adultery and still receive the sacraments. That's a very serious matter," he said, "and Catholics have to insist that the Church's discipline not be changed in some way which would in fact weaken our teaching on one of the most fundamental truths, the truth about marriage and the family." Thank God, I say, for Cardinal Burke. The Pontifical Council for the Family is at the present moment a house divided against itself, and its current leadership is submitting to an agenda that will prove radically destructive of our families. Let's never forget that fact. It's our families, yours and mine, which are under attack by certain senior clerics in Rome and elsewhere. The situation at the Pontifical Council is unfortunately indicative of a wider situation in Rome and in the Church as a whole. Faced with such a threat to our families, to our faith, and to our children, what can we as Catholics do? And non-Catholics too, I would say. Everyone has a stake in this matter. Now, in the first place, we must follow the call made by the Latvian Archbishop, the Archbishop of Riga, whom we were happy to meet in Rome, and commit ourselves to prayer. We must pray unceasingly for the Pope, for the cardinals, for the bishops, for clergy, religious and laity, that we may all remain firm and unyielding in our profession of the gospel. But though we, says St. Paul, or an angel from heaven preach a gospel to you other than that which we have preached to you, let him be anathema. Secondly, we must remember that we, the lay faithful, have both the right and duty to make known to our pastors our views about the crisis engulfing the church. We have a right and duty to require from our clergy unwavering obedience to the natural law and to the teaching of the church. No authority, not even the Pope, has the power or the right to alter in any way that which has been revealed to the church by Almighty God. Canon 211 of the Code of Canon Law states that, and I quote, all the Christian faithful have the duty and right to work so that the divine message of salvation more and more reaches all people in every age and in every land. And this is followed by Canon 212, which states, the Christian faithful are free to make known to the pastors of the church their needs, especially spiritual ones, and their desires, and it continues, according to the knowledge, competence, prestige which they possess, they have the right and even at times the duty to manifest to the sacred pastors their opinion on matters which pertain to the good of the church and to make their opinion known to the rest of the Christian faithful without prejudice to the integrity of faith and morals, with reverence towards their pastors and attentive to common advantage and the dignity of persons. Now, please let me know if you would like to receive from me by email Voice of the Family's full briefing on the Family Synod and the deeply disturbing developments connected to this synod. And please consider writing to, or better still, meeting your local bishop and the bishops elected by the United States Conference of Bishops to participate in the General Family Synod in October this year. The most notable achievement of the pro-life movement over the last 50 years is that we exist. Yes, pro-life organisations have enjoyed successes and saved lives. We've also had our setbacks. But brutally realistically, we're tiny compared with the overwhelming reach of the culture of death and compared with the universal reach of the Catholic Church in particular. That's why Catholics here and everyone here who has an interest in the common good must study what's happening at the highest levels in the church and take action. And we must have the maturity to speak out when things are badly wrong at the highest levels in the church. In June 2014, I had the privilege of addressing the Catholic bishops of Nigeria at a conference in Abuja on why the pro-life movement needs the Catholic Church. And I have a few copies of my talk with me this weekend, if any of you are interested in reading it. Finally, of course, we must strive to remain faithful in our own lives and strive with God's assistance to lead our families and all those with whom we come into contact to life in Jesus Christ. The pro-life movement must embrace the defence of marriage or face defeat, as the title of my talk this morning says. But at this stage in history, this is not primarily a political or legislative matter, albeit we must keep up the legislative battle and speak out politically, as Cleveland Right to Life is doing so courageously and prophetically. Embracing the defence of marriage is primarily about handing on what we know to be the truth about the nature of marriage to the next generation, upon whose shoulders the burden of the pro-life struggle is rapidly falling. That marriage is the exclusive lifetime union of one man and one woman, which is open to life and committed to the nurture and protection of their children. Now, I refer in particular, of course, to the inseparability of the unitive and procreative dimensions of the Marriage Act. Cardinal Burke, on the 9th of October 2010, at the World Pro-Life Prayer Congress for Life in Rome, said the following, and I quote, the attack on the innocent and defenceless life of the unborn has its origin in an erroneous view of human sexuality, which attempts to eliminate by mechanical or chemical means the essentially procreative nature of the conjugal act. The error maintains that the artificially altered conjugal act retains its integrity. The claim is, he said, that the act remains unitive or loving, even though the procreative nature has been radically violated. In fact, he said, it's not unitive, for one or both of the partners withholds an essential part of the gift of self, which is the essence of the conjugal union. The so-called contraceptive mentality, he said, is essentially anti-life. Many forms of so-called contraception are in fact abortifacient, he said. That is, they destroy at its beginning a life which has already been conceived. Now, dear fellow pro-lifers, it's never easy to say this, but it's never been more important to speak out. The use of contraceptive drugs and devices by so many Christians, including Catholics, which may, according to the manufacturers, cause an early abortion, is draining the pro-life movement of the support of the community most likely to support our battle against abortion. But couples who turn a blind eye to the practice of abortifacient birth control in the intimacy of their married lives may well find it difficult to support our unequivocal campaigns against abortion, IVF, human embryo research, and euthanasia. This understanding of pro-life work, linking unequivocal defense of the right to life to the truth about the transmission of human life through the Marriage Act, must become the foundation stone of the pro-life movement in the United States and worldwide. I think, in a sense, speaking on behalf of the oldest pro-life organization in the world, after nearly 50 years, our work is just beginning. Where do we begin? We begin with our families, with mothers and fathers as primary educators, whom John Paul II teaches that the church exists to serve. We want to see more of that serving. Parents, as the primary educators of their children, must find ways of teaching their children, including our older children who fled the nest, the truth about the sanctity of human life and its transmission, the truth found in Humani Vitae and in Evangelium Vitae and in Familiaris Consortio, because we have the right and the authority through the sacrament of marriage to do so, and because at this point in human history, the overwhelming majority of Episcopal leaders who also have authority are failing to do their duty. There's nothing left out there except our families, based on marriage between a man and a woman. There's nothing left out there to pick up the billions of broken babies, the billions of broken lives, and start again. At this point in history, observing events in the church and in the state, we have much to be fearful of, yet we know that we can take comfort from the fact that history shows that no matter how grave the crisis, a time will come when the church and her teaching will stand vindicated, while error and sin will stand powerless and condemned. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, in his book Wind, Sand and Stars, writes, "Water is worth its weight in gold. The smallest drop kindles in the sand the green spark of a blade of grass. If rain falls anywhere, a great exodus brings life to the Sahara. The modern West and the church in many other parts of the world seems, like the Sahara, to be a lifeless desert. Yet, just beneath the surface, life waits to be given the opportunity to spring forth. Faithful Catholics, all faithful Christians, all men and women of goodwill worldwide, many of whom we are privileged to work with in the pro-life movement, are the seeds of new life. Let us pray that the harvest will be very great in the months and years ahead. God bless America. God bless the American pro-life movement. God bless Molly, her committee, and her incredible volunteers. And God bless Cleveland Right to Life and its supporters, who truly are bringing America back to life."
You have been listening to John Smeaton, Chief Executive Director of the Society for the Protection of Unborn Children.